Book Waves on Cover to Cover. I'm Richard Walensky. My guest is Salman Rushdie, whose latest book is Luca and the Fire of Life. Earlier books include Midnight's Children, Satanic Verses, Shalimar the Clown more recently, and The Enchantress of Florence. Also, Haroon and the Sea of Stories, of which this is, if not a sequel, it is a sort of second in a series, let's say.
Yeah, it's a kind of companion piece.
What I did is I reread Haroon and the Sea of Stories in anticipation of reading this, and I wanted to put that book in the context of when it was written, which was at the tail end of that year that you spent in hiding. Is that correct?
It was the first thing, really, I wrote after the attack on the Satanic Verses. It was a very bad time of my life, and not only of my life, but my son, Zafar, who was then just turning 10 years old. And I had talked to him earlier, like before there was any trouble, about writing a book that he would like to read, which he had actually encouraged me to do. And so then after the enormous trouble began, which, as I say, was also a problem in his life, not just in mine, I mean, I thought that I should keep that promise. And that's what pushed me back to writing. And Haroon and the Sea of Stories actually had its point of origin in stories I had told him, you know, in more innocent times. But then it, of course, developed a dimension which was to talk about, in a fable-like way, to talk about the stuff that was actually happening in our lives. You know, so it became, to an extent, an allegory of that.
The main character, Haroon, is, of course, your son. But Khalifa, the father, who's the storyteller, you've said that that's actually your father.
Well, it's a mixture. It's a mixture of my dad and me. You know, I mean, obviously, I can't deny that there are aspects of Rashid Khalifa, the storyteller, which is kind of me sending myself up, you know, sort of having fun at my own expense. But it's also very much the case that the first storyteller in my life was my dad, and that he instilled in me, I think, the love of stories which I've had ever since. And he was a great bedtime storyteller, and my sisters and I would have stories from him, you know, most nights. And many of the great stories of the East, the great wonder tales of the East, I heard first in his versions of them, you know, kind of Sinbad the Sailor and Aladdin, Ali Baba kind of story. And so a little bit of the Shah of Bla is my dad as well.
Well, when he was telling you those stories, this was in Bombay?
Yes.
And, I mean, you had a TV and...
No, there was no such thing as TV. When I was growing up in India, there was no television at all. This was in the 50s. The television didn't arrive in India until the late 60s.
The late 60s?
The late 60s.
Bollywood was around then,
yes,
right?
There were movies and there was radio, but that's it.
So the traditions that you grew up in are more akin to, say, my parents' traditions, where there was radio and books and
yes,
storytelling. That's about it.
That's right. You know, I really didn't have a television set until after I left university. Because, you know, first I was in India where they had no TV. Then I went to an English boarding school where you weren't allowed to watch TV. And then I went to Cambridge University in the mid-60s where it was really uncool to watch TV. You know, and so really when I graduated from Cambridge in 68 and got an apartment in London, I got a television. It was my first television.
That means that in terms of pop culture, among your contemporaries, you were in a kind of strange place.
It was odd, but I mean, of course, the pop culture we had, which we were much more interested in than television, was music. You know, and it was the great age of rock and roll, you know, so that's what we had. And so, yes, it's true that storytelling was still a very, you know, vital part of childhood when I was growing up.
In terms of your children, I mean, did you try to keep that up and realizing that you were competing now with television, with
yes,
video, with DVDs and games?
Yes. I mean, I have tried, and I'm happy to say that they are both readers of books. I mean, my younger son, I think, is probably the bigger reader of the two, actually, in spite of the fact that in his lifetime, the temptations to do other stuff even more plentiful than they were when my older son was a kid. He loves to read.
Does he write, too? Do they write?
He's beginning to write shockingly well at school, making up stories and things like that.
Let's go back to the origins of Haroon and the Sea of Stories. Okay, you had been, and we've discussed this before, you had been in kind of depressed, and you weren't allowed to go out. You had these guards, and you and your wife at the time were fighting to gain some freedom. It was like you were in a prison.
Yes.
Was that the point when you began saying, I've got to get back into writing? What did that moment?
Well, as I say, it was, you're right. It was all those things that you say. And also a moment at which I had become very, very unhappy about being a writer, because it had seemed so disappointing, you know, the way in which everything had happened around the Satanic Verses. But then really what drew me back to writing was what I thought of as an unbreakable imperative, which is a promise to a child. And I just thought I'd better do this.
And when you did it, you realized that there was a way, as people have done for a long time, to use the story as metaphor.
Yes.
And in this case, a metaphor about storytelling itself.
Yeah, it just suddenly struck me that not only was it a story that I could use to talk about what was happening in my life, but that actually it was a really good vehicle, that fable-like story, to examine the ideas involved in what was happening to me. And so it ended up being the right book to write at the right time.
When you were finishing it, did you realize, oh, now I'm a writer again? Is that sort of...
It sort of did bring me back to writing. Yes, it did. It did bring me back to writing. It gave me back my balance, and it reminded me of what I loved, you know, because actually the writing of these two books, of both Haroon and the Sea of Stories and this one, Luca and the Fire of Life, have just really been the most pleasurable. I mean, it seems odd because that was, as I said, not a pleasurable time. But my memory of writing the book is that it was very pleasurable to write.
It felt to me in reading Enchantress of Florence, as opposed to Fury or Shalimar, the other books, it seemed like you were beginning to get more playful just in that book.
Yes, I think that's true. I think that's true. I mean, the Enchantress of Florence is, in some ways, a more adult go at this kind of writing. You know, I mean, it also has kind of fable-like aspects. But obviously, in terms of language and form, it is more adult than this.
Well, after Haroon came out, it became a play. Did you work on that?
I did. I worked a little on it. I mean, actually, truthfully, the director of the play, Tim Supple, mostly did the adaptation. But what he did was to use only lines from the book. So when he showed me the script that he was proposing, every line of the script was a line from the book. So it was as if I'd written the script, except that I didn't. You know, the thing about both these books, both Haroon and Luca, are books which are very dialogue-heavy.
Right.
I mean, there's a lot of dialogue. And so that made it, of course, made his job as an adapter easier. He could just lift the dialogue from the book and use it in the play.
What prompted you after writing Florence? Did your son,
my younger son,
suddenly said, you've been promising me this for a while?
Well, the truth is that because I had remembered the experience of writing Haroon as being such a good experience, the moment I had a second son, I thought, well, one of these days when he's old enough, I will probably try and have another go at doing it for him. But then what happened is that he read Haroon and the Sea of Stories when he must have been about 9 or 9 and a half, something, and immediately began to point out that he deserved a book too. You know, so I allowed him to feel that he bludgeoned me into it. But the truth is that I wanted to do it anyway.
Well, it's all about fathers and sons, as is the first one, but this one is also about mortality.
Yes. I mean, I think I had to find a different engine because, you know, we've been speaking about what was the motivation for writing that earlier book, and clearly by the time I came around to writing this one, that was no longer the engine that one could use, you know, because that, fortunately, that part of my life had gone away. But the thing that was the obvious truth about my relationship with my younger son is that I'm much older than him. That, you know, when he was born, I turned 50 about 3 weeks after he was born. And if you are an older parent, if you have a child later in life, then that subject, the subject of life and death, of mortality, is always in your thoughts, you know, in a way that it's not when you have a child in your 20s or early 30s or something. So I had always worried, and I thought, when this kid is 20, I'll be 70 years old. You know, and you want to stick around and help your children grow up and watch them come to adulthood and so on. And so I thought this would be, if you like, what Philip Pullman would call dark material. This would be the dark material at the heart of this book, is the subject of life and death itself. I've always liked writing kind of against the grain of the material. So if the subject is something like death, you should make it as funny as possible.
Now, I noticed that Haroon and this book, the openings are more detailed, more realistic, and gradually, as you step into the other world, not only does it become more fantastic, but the style of writing changes as well.
That's true. I mean, I think that I deliberately wanted to say, here are real people in a real place with real relationships and real problems. And then the leap into fantasy becomes a way of discussing those problems in another fictional language. But if you don't believe in the reality of the situation, then the fantasy has no affect. You know? I mean, it's only if you believe that Luca is a real boy and this is a real father and they have a real relationship and the boy is really frightened that his father's going to die. Unless you have that truth of emotion, you know, unless the reader feels the truth of that emotion, it's not interesting that he goes off and defeats dragons and extinguishes firebugs and does all that stuff.
At the beginning, I noticed, having just reread Haroon, that the opening of Haroon, we do get there faster. And this one, you really try to create the modern world, which you didn't really try to do in the earlier
one. No, it's true. It's a bit different. Because also, after that, once he moves off into the fantastic world, there's a real acceleration, I think. And I think the book after that goes very, very fast. And the reason for that is that it's, again, if you like, a realistic reason, that once he realizes that his father may be dying and that his only chance of saving his father's life is to do this impossible thing, which is to enter the magical world and steal this magical object, the Fire of Life, and bring it back in time. Well, there's an urgency about that. If you think your dad's about to die, you don't have much time. And what's more, you don't know how much time you've got. So you have to go really like grease lightning. You know? And so I wanted the book to have that sense of urgency, you know, there being no time to lose, etc. So there's deliberately a period, the beginning of the book, a more, if you like, stable moment when you can explore the world of the family and what's going on there. And then this zoom, this acceleration towards the attempt to save the life.
The city in Haroon is still a fictional city, but here I feel, are we in Bombay?
We are and we aren't. I mean, let's say, the city in Haroon was also sort of based on Bombay, but it was deliberately not called Bombay. For instance, in this city, there's a river. There's a sort of dirty old river that makes its way through the town, a working river that has riverboats, traffic going up and down it, which at a certain point in the story, when they step into the parallel magic world, that dirty old river becomes the gleaming and shining magic river of time that they have to travel up. But Bombay has no river. I mean, okay. Bombay is a city by the sea. It has a sea, but it doesn't have a river. You know, so I just put one in.
Well, when he goes into that world, it becomes brighter, and does in Haroon too, but here it's very specifically made that way. Obviously, we're getting illusions, and immediately I thought of the film version of Wizard of Oz at that point.
Hmm. I've always said I'm fond of the Wizard of Oz, and there are one or two allusions to it in the book, but really I wanted to say that the imagined world is a place of brighter colors. You know, that's to say that when we are in that dream world, everything is exaggerated. You know, the noises are louder, the colors are brighter, the people are weirder, the events are stranger. Everything is, if you like, more. So I just wanted it to have a kind of feeling of excess, you know, when you get into that world.
And the driving force is a character named Aag, A-A-G. Is that a real...
Well, Aag is just the Hindustani word that means fire. And Captain Aag is one of the bad guys in the book, and fiery. I mean, he has red hair that explodes from him in all directions.
The other character is an angel of death creature called Nobad Daddy. And I notice what you do for many of the characters in Sultana is you take two words and
push them together. Yes. Well, Nobodaddy, I have to confess, is not my invention. It's actually William Blake's invention. There's a poem of Blake's called To Nobodaddy, which is Nobodaddy for Blake was a name for God. It was a name for the God who never shows up, who's absent, the kind of absentee father. The poem is a complaint against God. And it says, where are you? You're not, what kind of father are you that you're never there to help me? You don't give me advice. You don't show up. And in this book, I took the name because I liked that kind of portmanteau quality of it, of pushing together nothingness and fatherhood. But he is more a figure of death and divine in this book.
Well, he's also a great character. And to me, when I read a lot of books like even Lord of the Rings or most of these fantasy books, the character that always sticks out is the gray one, the Gollum.
Yes.
And
yes.
He is the gray character.
Yes, he is. Because, of course, the fact that he looks, sounds, and behaves exactly like Luca's actual father makes him confusing. Because it's very easy for Luca to slip into a kind of filial relationship with him and think of him as helpful and paternal in the way that his actual father is. And he keeps having to remind himself to beware that this guy actually has a different agenda and is not finally on his side. You know, and it's in a way playing with him, toying with him, while actually hoping to take his father's life.
Which is a very adult kind of concept. And even a character like Gollum, the agenda is clear. But here the agenda really isn't that clear.
No, he's playing. You know, I mean, I think the thing about Nobodaddy is he's just amusing himself. He's gradually absorbing the fading life force of the dying man. And he knows that that's going to go at its own speed, you know, and he just has to allow it to happen, and it's going to happen. And in the meanwhile, he's in a rather kind of black comedic way having fun.
In terms of the power of modern mythologies, I noticed that you gave a lot of shout-outs in there. There's a certain point, for instance, where a certain blue police box materializes.
Yes, from Doctor Who, it's true. At that moment in the story, Lucar and his friends, companions, are traveling backwards up the river of time. They're going back in time, as it were, towards the source of stories, which is also at the dawn of time. You know, so they're making this journey back along the time trail. And I thought if they were doing that, it might be appropriate for them to run into other time travelers. And so there are appearances not only by Doctor Who, but the Terminator is there at one point, and the Terry Gilliam's Time Bandits show up at a certain point, and even Mark Twain's Connecticut Yankee is seen sleeping under a tree. And I just thought, you know, if that's where you are, if you're making that journey, those might be the people you would run into, other people doing the same thing.
You also make shout-outs to every single mythology and religion out there, even just in passing, whirligigs from Fatal Pippity?
Yes, I made that up. Some of them are real and some of them not. And it's difficult because some of the real mythologies do have, you know, bizarre-sounding names of deities and so on. But one of the reasons for doing it was I discovered, as I was doing my sort of reading around the subject for this book, that, you know, somehow in all these different worlds, cultures, time periods, we end up telling the same stories. That the story of the theft of fire is a story you find in every single culture in the world, whether you're looking in China or Korea or Native American stories or South America or Greek and Roman and Nordic, you know, every single mythology that you will look at in the world has a story about the theft of fire. And it seems as if it may have been one of the first stories that human beings told each other. You know, because, of course, the acquisition of fire is one of the great moments in the development of the species. It's one of the things that made us human. So it seems to me that the two oldest stories that you find when you read around this material are the story of the theft of fire and the story about the invention of the sky god. Every single culture invents the sky god, who in some way creates the world. What it showed me was that you could make, if you like, a union of the world's stories, in a way to be the opposite of what we keep being told right now, which is about the clash of civilizations and so on, you know, to show that actually if you look at our civilizations at their root, at their point of origin, they're all the same. You know, we all tell ourselves the same stories.
What do you think that is? Is it that Jungian idea of the archetype, the unconscious?
Well, I think it's what we are as human beings. These are the stories the species tells itself because this is the species we are. You know, I've begun to think in the way that, you know, in Steven Pinker in his great book, The Language Instinct, says that the reason why children are able to acquire language so easily, it seems, even though it's such a difficult thing to acquire, is because it's somehow built into the DNA. It's somehow the language instinct is built into the program, and our DNA gives us the tools with which to grasp language. I begin to think that we have also an instinct for story, because if you think about it, when children are born, it's one of the first needs. You know, you have sustenance, and after that you want somebody to sing you a song and tell you a story.
That even comes before you ask the question, why?
Yes, you just want somebody to say, once upon a time. There's a moment in the book where Lucar makes the mistake, a kind of slip of the tongue, of referring to something as only a story. And actually, it's the death character, Nobodaddy, who tells him off, who says, look, you of all people, you know, you the storyteller's son, you should know better than to say that something's only a story. And he says, man alone is the storytelling animal. And I think that's true. We are the only creature on the earth that does this very strange thing of telling each other stories, some of them true stories, some of them untrue stories, as a way of understanding the kind of creature that we are. You know, Nobodaddy has this sort of comic riff about how other creatures don't do it. He says, do rats tell tales? Do porpoises have narrative purposes? Do elephants elephanticize? No, they don't. This is uniquely a human activity, the telling of stories. And so the book suggests that because of that, it may well be something very close to the heart of our nature as human beings, and therefore to be cherished because of that.
As you're talking, the story kind of gets deeper and deeper, because it isn't merely a children's story. It's something else.
No, but nothing is merely, you know, if you think about Alice, the books that I love more than any other so-called children's books, you know, the two Alice books, Lewis Carroll was, you know, he was a philosopher, he was a logician, he was a mathematician, and in those books he embeds all kinds of quite profound ideas, but done up in this kind of higher nonsense. You know, when we are asked to consider the difference between saying what we mean and meaning what we say, that's quite a profound question. When Humpty Dumpty, sitting on his wall, talks about language and says that he says something like, when I use a word, it means what I want it to mean, neither more nor less. I mean, he sounds like any politician, twisting language in his own need. And those Alice books contain much that you would think of as adult material. But, of course, they're tricked out in this wonderful, fabulous, antic mischief.
Supposedly, The Wizard of Oz is all about the gold standard.
So. Yes, exactly, or the silver standard. Because originally the ruby slippers were silver shoes because of Frank Baum's interest in silver as opposed to gold.
Salman Rushdie, modern mythologies. I mean, you bring some of those in there, but more in the way of comparing them to the older ones. So Lord of the Rings is mentioned. Mm-hmm. Middle-earth, I recall, being mm-hmm. mentioned. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Doctor Who in passing, not merely because it's supposed to be there, and, of course, video games as mm-hmm. well. Do you think we can take those modern mythologies, whatever they are, and relate them back? And I'm thinking of created Hollywood images like Freddy Krueger or Jason.
Shared knowledge is a very interesting area, you know, the kind of knowledge that we can assume that each other knows. And it used to be the case that mythologies were like that, that if I was to talk about Zeus or Poseidon or Prometheus, that I would have a reasonable expectation that the people I was talking to would know what I meant by that. Now I think we can't use that shorthand. I mean, that's the thing, that shared information is shorthand. It's a way of talking about things without having to explain them too much. Now, I do think we have to look for other shared mythologies, other shared information, even though it might be of a sort of lower grade. You know, I mean, we probably all know Beatles lyrics. If I was to say the line of a Beatles song, you could probably say the next line. And we all watch the same television programs. And so I think you have to look, if you're a person like me who is interested in building fictions which in part use the shared information of the race, you know, you have to look and see where that information now is. And it may well be in things like, you know, the movies and television and music, rather than in these more erudite forms.
That brings back something you said before about reading around the subject. I mean, how far are you going to read around a particular subject in order to both be erudite and connect with the audience at the same time?
Well, I do. I mean, I just like to know the kind of neck of the woods I'm in, if you know what I mean. So if I'm trying to write a certain kind of story, I like to look at what relates to that, you know, what has gone before. And as you say, not only what has gone before, but what's around now that may relate to it.
Salman Rushdie, where does manufactured political mythologies fit into all this?
It's a very good question, because I do think that we have always, I think, lived in a world where people with power have made up versions of the world in order to justify their actions and have encouraged us to agree with their versions of the world. I think that's one of the reasons why politicians and writers so often find themselves at loggerheads, because there's a quarrel about the versions of the world. And I do think there are many parts of the world now where there are, so to speak, incompatible narratives at war with each other. And if you think about the Middle East, you know, you have a Palestinian narrative and you have an Israeli narrative about that land. And those two narratives can't coexist. They contradict each other so radically that they go to war. And I think one of the things we see very much in the world now is narratives arguing with each other, because we can no longer agree on what is the case. I mean, in the age of the great 19th century novel, broadly speaking, the writer and his audience would agree on the nature of reality. They would agree that the world is like this. Now, the world is very contested, and the nature of reality is what is true, What is real? What does an action mean? Who is history and who writes history? One man's revolutionary, another man's terrorist, you know, etc. This problem of just agreeing what the world is and how it's working creates conflicting narratives. You know, and I think everywhere in the world now, what you see is narratives at war with each other.
Well, I was thinking when you were talking before about the commonality of television, I kept thinking, yes, but if you or I try talking to someone who watches Fox religiously, we're not even speaking the same language.
That's true. That's true. And if you and I talk to somebody who watches Jersey Shore religiously, we're also not talking the same language.
Do you, as an artist, do you see it's your job in a way maybe to sometimes bridge those gaps, or do you ignore that?
I've always been a writer who's very interested in popular culture. You know, I've always thought, if you're a writer, you need to know how people of your time really think, what's really in their heads, not what ought to be in their heads, but what's actually in their heads. You know, and in order to do that, you do have to inform yourself a little bit about stuff that might not even be to your taste. I've watched episodes of Glenn Beck and then watched.
Salman Rushdie, did you make up Shah of Blah?
Yes, I did. I made up the Shah of Blah. I decided that Rashid the storyteller needed two nicknames. One of them, a nickname given to him by people who liked his stories, who called him the Ocean of Notions, and the other given to him by people who didn't much like his stories, who called him the Shah of Blah.
As I was reading the book, there were a couple of times when I'd kind of pause and I said, is this working? And then I thought, you know, he's writing this to his son. And the moment I said that, certain things like the allusions to video games suddenly clicked in. It's like he's pulling that in to make it real for the kid.
No, because I think what's happened in the 20 years since I wrote Harun and the Sea of Stories, this whole virtual world has exploded into our consciousness to a degree that it didn't exist. I mean, there were video games 20 years ago. The beginnings of Super Mario and the beginnings of Sonic the Hedgehog and so on, it was in an earlier stage. What's happened is that the complexity of these games, the variety of these games, and just their place at the center of young people's lives has become much more evident and much bigger than it used to be. And I also struck me that almost nobody that I could look at was doing anything about that in writing, in books. You know, nobody was responding to that. And I thought, here's this very large phenomenon that has happened in the lives of young people, and nobody is writing about it. You know, and that's, of course, a temptation. The moment you find somewhere to go where almost nobody's gone before, you really want to go there.
This is the first time I've seen people gain and lose lives, and yet that's so common.
And you see, again, one of the ways in which it helped me in the book is that the book is about life. You know, the book is about an actual human life of which there's only one, and it's very precious, and you can't renew it, and if you lose it, it's gone. And that's what Luca is trying to save. It's a life that also made extra precious because it belongs to his dad. That's what life means in the real world, you know, where you and I live, and so does Luca and his father. Then there's this other idea of life in the virtual world where life is plentiful. You know, you jump on a toadstool and lives fall out of it. You shake a tree and lives fall down from the branches.
Which you have in the book. Yeah,
and you collect lives.
Yeah.
And to lose a life is not the same thing as dying. So on the one hand, this trivial idea of life is endlessly replenishable. And on the other hand, this idea of life is precious and singular. You know, and I wanted to contrast those two.
But, of course, when the life is precious and singular, the stakes are much higher.
Exactly. And the only way you can create those higher stakes in the virtual world, which is what happens to him as he gets further up the river, you know, higher up the levels, so to speak, is that there is a danger that no matter how many lives he's got, he's going to lose them all. Because, you know, when he makes a mistake, he'll lose 150 lives at a time. You know, it's not a question of one. And there are points when he realizes that he's only really got one more go at doing something, because otherwise he's finished. So you have to create the tension within the language of the game, if you like. Even though lives are plentiful and replenishable, they are still not infinite. They can still run out.
I remember some conflict in the summer about the movie Inception. It's supposed to be in dreams, but it felt more like a computerized virtual reality.
Mm-mm.
And I was thinking that what you're doing here is you're taking fantasy world, dream world, and virtual reality.
Mm-mm.
But of course, it's not virtual reality in the way we know it.
No, it's not. I mean, I just thought in the end, I guess I'm too old-fashioned to go completely into this techno world, you know, and my view is an old-fashioned view of fantasy worlds, which is you have to know their geography. In The Lord of the Rings, there's a map, so you could see what the journey is. Where are the mountains? Where are the rivers? Where are the caves? Where are the dangerous people? You know, where are the good guys? And I felt I had to also, in my mind, understand the shape of the world, the layout of the world. Then, yes, you have to. It has to have a history and a culture, which, of course, Tolkien famously, you know, labored for decades creating that backstory and using only like a hundredth of it in the book itself. But his knowledge of the backstory informs the whole of the story he tells and makes it richer.
Well, did you create any kind of backstory in the same way? Did you write out a map and give a history that?
I did make sketches. I mean, I didn't do the whole detailed cartography, but I did have sketches of how this world went. And, you know, there's a moment in the book when Lucar is up on a flying carpet and zooming along high up so he can see a long way every direction. And he realizes that this world is very, very large. There's this land over here and that land over there and this one to the left and this one behind him. And he realizes, and then the reader, I think, realizes that you can't go to all these places. Or you could see them, but I have to know them in order to imply the world that is not visited. I have to know what that world is. But again, because he is on this hell for leather quest, you know, to try and steal the fire of life, he doesn't have time for, you know, side journeys. He's got to stay on the road and go as fast as he can.
Do you see yourself ever going back to that world then?
Maybe. You know, my son Milan, when I was writing this book, said to me, "Dad, don't write novels, write series."
Don't, please, don't.
Well, it worked very well for J.K. Rowling. Well, I don't know about series, but I do have a kind of interest in the rule of three. You know, I think if you've done two of something, maybe you should do three of it. There is this world in my head that I made up for these two books that has not been fully explored. There are other directions that the stories could go in. Maybe there's another adventure lurking somewhere, but I don't know what it is.
Salman Rushdie, I understand you're working on a film version of Midnight's Children?
We've been working on it for a couple of years now, and I'm lucky, I think, in that we have this wonderful film director, Deepa Mehta, who's a Canadian-based Indian filmmaker who made this wonderful film, Water, that was nominated for an Academy Award a couple of years ago. And that's part of a trilogy, Earth, Fire. I mean, the thing that I like about her is that she is at the same time lyrical and intimate and epic and historical. And that, I think, those are good qualities to try and have a go at making a film of Midnight's Children. So I've written the screenplay, which has took a long time to, you know, boil that enormous novel down to a 2-hour or 2-hour and 10-minute movie. But now it seems to be in a shape where people like it. And we're not quite done. We're still raising the money. We're beginning to cast it. We're probably halfway through casting it. We've got some very good people. You know, I hope that we will get to film it in the coming year.
Did you find in working on the screenplay, did Salman, the novelist, ever conflict and have a battle with Salman, the screenwriter?
Well, of course, there are moments which are when you have to make cuts that are very painful to make. You know, there's sequences you have to leave out that you really wish you didn't have to leave out. But I think in some ways that I was probably able to be more disrespectful of the text than anyone else would have been. You know, I think you get some other screenwriter in who thinks, oh, it's Midnight's Children, it's, you know, it's got this and that reputation. That writer might well feel constrained by, if you like, the reputation of the novel. Whereas I'm the one who can say, well, let's just throw that bit out and change this and do that differently and combine these two characters. And I think also because I'm somebody who has loved movies all his life. And I mean, I do know quite a lot about movies. You know, I'm involved with them in various ways. I've been on the...
Well, you've been in them.
and also, you know, Tom Luddy here has involved me from a long time ago in the Telluride Film Festival, which he runs, and I'm on that advisory committee, and I've been the guest director there, and so on. So, I mean, I know about movies, and I know that movies are a very different thing than books. And in the end, I want it to be a good movie. You know, and there's a point at which that takes over from the matter of literal adaptation. You know, and you have to just think, what would make a good movie?
Were you working in the constraints of Act 1, Act 2, Act 3?
I don't buy all that nonsense. I just think what I do is a simple way of writing a screenplay for me is that you just close your eyes and run the movie in your head. And then you open your eyes and write it down. I have the advantage that I know the storyline of the book very well. Then the question was how to refine that. And it was, in the end, I thought it was a real challenge and an interesting one to ask myself 30 years later the question of what is the essence of this book? You know, what is the story that you have to tell without which it's not a film of Midnight's Children? And once you can boil the book down to that, then these large sections, because it's a digressive novel, you know, it goes off in all kinds of directions. And some of those sections are very enjoyable to me, you know, and no doubt it may disappoint lovers of the book to find things missing. You know, but what I hope is that they will see that there's a coherent film. If that happens, if the film can establish its own authority as a piece of work, you know, then I think people will go for it. So that's what we're trying to do.
Do you plan to take any of your other books? I mean, Shalimar the Clown kind of seems to me to be cinematic.
The problem is, these are not great days in the film industry. It's,
right.
You know, and they're not very adventurous days. I think Shalimar the Clown would make a good film. I've always thought that The Enchantress of Florence would make an interesting film. And I think these two books, I think Harun and the Sea of Stories and Luca and The Fire of Life taken together, you know, could be an interesting pair of films because at least they correspond to the wide interest in fantasy movies that there now is.
There's also something new which has come out, which in some ways is more important and better than film, which is the television long form as well.
Mm-hmm. I'm open to it, but it's very interesting, finally, to have somebody seriously interested in making a film one of my books because it just hasn't happened up to now. I mean, there are friends of mine like, you know, McEwen and Ishiguro, right, who only seem to have to sneeze for it to be turned into a movie.
I think we'll have to wait a while for Satanic Verses.
Yes, that's not going to happen, I think. But as I say, I do think there are books of mine that could be done, but I've always thought that the way it's going to happen for me, which is the way it has happened, is for the creative element of filmmaking, the directors or the stars, to become obsessed with a project and then work to make it happen. What I mean is not going to happen by selling the rights to a studio. So I look for, if you like, for creative collaborators. I try to see where is there a director who might really respond to this material? Where is there an actor who might fall in love with the idea of doing this part? Who is an actor of sufficient weight that they could actually start a ball rolling? So I think for me it has to happen that way.
So it's never going to be take the money and run, which a lot of people just say, to hell with it, let's do it.
Well, nobody's ever offered the money.
Do you find that despite your acclaim and your successes that people still run from the name because they're afraid of...
No, not because of fear, but because of fear of complexity. Hollywood is a very simple-minded place. They like things to be clear and, as you say, fall in neatly into a three-act format and so on and so on. If they're shown work which is, in their terms, difficult because it doesn't fall neatly into that shape, they somehow don't respond to it very often. It's more a sort of a kind of American fear of intelligence.
You spend quite a bit of time with people like Kazuo Ishiguro, with Ian McEwan, Christopher Hitchens,
yes.
Martin Amis is another one. What kind of cross-pollination do you think goes on among you?
Well, it's more to do with mutual support than anything else, you know, because I think we all know that, first of all, we are very different kinds of writers. And certainly we're very much our own people, you know. I mean, I think Martin and Ian and all of these writers, they know where they're going as writers. And they, you know, and the stuff in their head is not really something that I or any of their other friends would really influence. But what we can do is be sounding boards and places where we could offer each other a place where we could talk about what we're doing and talk about it to people who are friends, but also do the same job and are also really good at it and are also very articulate about it, you know, so it helps in that way.
You got your son to interview J.K. Rowling?
Yeah, I did. J.K. Rowling came to New York and did the thing that no other writer in the world can do, which is to fill Radio City Music Hall for three nights consecutively with, as her supporting act, Stephen King and John Irving. The publishers had asked for various people, including me, to just be planted in the audience to ask questions, just to make it a more enjoyable evening for the audience. And I said, well, I'll do it, but I'll only do it if my son gets to meet J.K. Rowling. So I negotiated a few minutes backstage.
Well, what did he ask?
He was asking the kind of questions that might lead to a doctoral thesis. You know, he was saying things like, you know, in volume 3, you have Snape saying such and such, but doesn't that contradict what happens in volume 6 when he does this and this? It really was, you know, very hard line questioning. And she was sort of slightly amazed, I think, it was saying, gosh, you really read these books very carefully.
Do you have anything Anything that you're working on now? Any books?
Well, I'm just beginning a book that people have told me to write for a long time, and I finally come around to wanting to write it, which is an autobiography. So there's material that I have covered, but the real subject, beginning with the subject of what happened to the Satanic Verses, a lot of that is not in the public domain. Initially, I thought maybe I just need to tell that story. And then what happened is I realized that in order to tell that story, I've got to tell the story of everybody involved in that story, including me. Otherwise, readers don't care about them. You know, you have to know to whom the story is happening. Otherwise, as a reader, you don't care. So in the end, it becomes very novelistic. In the end, really, more or less exactly as in a novel, I've got to create characters on the page that are interesting for people to read about and then put them through this narrative.
When you're doing that, there are two ways to look at it. One is, I'm going to study everything and not indicate anything that isn't real. Mm. Keep away from dialogue because I can't remember what it is. And then there's the Amos Oz approach, which is almost novelistic, but not quite.
Yeah, I'd be closer to that, really, I think. Because I think the point is to make it come alive on the page so that people are interested to read it. I think the issue of truth is important, though. I think it's very important not to make happen things that didn't happen. I mean, it's perfectly possible for dialogues to contain combinations of things that people said to each other at different times, but they should be things that those people did say, you know, rather than putting words in people's mouths. So I think there can be simplifications and compressions and condensations of reality, but I think you have to remember that the truth is the truth. And if you're telling a book whose purpose is to tell the truth, you shouldn't really make it up.
You've been listening to an interview with Salman Rushdie, whose latest novel is Luca and the Fire of Life. I'm Richard Walensky on Cover to Cover.